Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Joe Zimmel and Valerie Friedman.
This week on The Wheelhouse. Political dysfunction in Bridgeport. It's The Wheelhouse. In absentia. For Connecticut Public, I'm Frankie Graziano. This is The Wheelhouse, the show that connects politics to the people. We got your weekly dose of politics in Connecticut and beyond, right here. We're switching things up this week in honor of a brand new podcast from Connecticut Public. It's called In Absentia. It's a four-part investigation examining the history of political dysfunction in Bridgeport, Connecticut. Yeah, we talk about that place a lot here on The Wheelhouse, right? Podcast dives deep into the systems that enable that political dysfunction and what that all means for the people wondering, does my vote count? Coming up in a little bit of conversation with one of In Absentia's hosts, investigative reporter Bria Lloyd of Connecticut Public's The Accountability Project. And later on, we'll check in with another one of my colleagues, federal policy reporter Lisa Hagen, for the latest on the Hill with Connecticut's federal delegation. But first, grab the popcorn and settle in. Here comes, in its entirety, the very first episode of In Absentia.
You know those hidden camera shows, like Candid Camera and Punked? The whole idea behind them is pretty simple. Hide some cameras and then see how an ordinary person reacts to some unusual, possibly ridiculous situation.
The setups were always contrived, but people's reaction to them, not so much. Those hidden cameras often revealed a lot about human behavior and what we do when we think people aren't watching.
This story starts with a similar premise, but with much higher stakes. We're not talking about practical jokes. We're talking about election integrity. And a local story that gained national attention.
Allegations of absentee ballot fraud in Bridgeport, all after video was leaked showing a woman stuffing envelopes into the ballot drop box.
Donald Trump, his former lawyer, Sidney Powell, even Elon Musk have all posted about this. They say Bridgeport proves their claims that the 2020 election was rigged.
They're talking about a video that shows a woman in Bridgeport, Connecticut, walking over to a ballot box in the early hours of the morning. And yeah, the music playing under the video is dramatic. She drops a stack of papers inside, and those papers, well, they look like they could be absentee ballots. Moments later, as she's walking away, she turns around. She goes back to the box and does it all over again and again.
Now, this footage wasn't captured by a bunch of TV producers. It was captured by a surveillance camera outside of a government building. This ballot box incident took place just days before Bridgeport's Democratic primary election in September 2023.
After the election, a man named John Gomes somehow gets a hold of the video and shares it with the public.
My name is John Gomes.
Gomes is a mayoral candidate in the race.
Gomes lost that primary election to incumbent Mayor Joe Ganim. But because of this video, the results of that primary were tossed out entirely. Gomes filed a lawsuit asking for a redo. He believed ballots were illegally placed into the box and that he lost the race unfairly.
The fundamental issue here is that civil rights were violated when we talk about the voters of Bridgeport. And we want clarity, we want integrity back in the vote.
This video caused upheaval in Bridgeport, and for us reporters, too. Months before the primary, we set out to report on the long history of political dysfunction in the city. We talked to dozens of people, from longtime politicians to everyday residents. The video added a whole new layer to the story.
We'll dive more into the outcome of the lawsuit later. Some of it as we report in real time. But first, we need to explain why this all matters. For years, people have said that something is going on with absentee ballots in Bridgeport. People have been fined over misuse of absentee ballots. There have been investigations by state agencies and rumors among Bridgeport residents that elections in the city are not fair.
The 2023 election is not the first race that's had absentee ballot problems, but it might be the first time alleged misconduct was captured on video. And for some, it feels like deja vu. That's because similar allegations surfaced in 2019, the last time there was a race for mayor. And it sent local reporters scrambling.
Bridgeport, known for ballot problems in the past, appears to be headed for them again.
There's a lawsuit on the books claiming supporters of Mayor Joe Ganim gave absentee ballots to those who did not qualify for them and didn't ask for them.
None of that changed the outcome of the election. Mayor Ganim kept on winning. Now, Ganim isn't personally accused of any wrongdoing in these elections, but he's a really intriguing politician. And that's in part because he previously went to prison. He was convicted on corruption charges back in 2003, during his first stretch in office.
That period of time was surrounded by scandal, but he bounced back and became the mayor again. Here's Ganim.
Tonight, we've not only made history, but we've defined a new course for this great city.
To be clear, the absentee ballot controversy and the corruption charges against Ganim are two completely separate things. But what do they tell us about power and accountability in the city? From Connecticut Public, I'm Bria Lloyd.
And I'm Kate Seltzer.
This is In Absentia, a podcast about political dysfunction in Bridgeport, Connecticut.
The systems that enable it.
And what this all means for the residents who wonder if their vote even matters.
We'll talk more about voting later in the series.
But in this first episode, we're going back to the 1990s, around when Mayor Joe Ganim entered the world of Bridgeport city politics.
Bria takes it from here.
From a distance, it was, this is exciting. Someone young, fresh, smart, energetic has been elected.
He looks you in the eye and makes you feel like you're important. And that's a gift. He became very popular in the 1990s to the point where he was a rising star in state politics.
To understand who Joe Ganim is, we have to understand where he came from. He spent his early years in two different Connecticut communities, Bridgeport and Easton. They're roughly 10 miles apart, but they have stark differences. Easton is a pretty small but wealthy farm town. And Bridgeport, well, it's the largest city in the state with a median household income of about $50,000. For a century, Bridgeport was an industrial hub, with factories everywhere. There were lots of jobs. People flocked to Bridgeport for work.
You had some of the major corporations in the nation were headquartered here.
Chris Caruso was born and raised in Bridgeport.
Dictaphone Corporation, Singer Sewing Company was here, Columbia Records was here.
By the 80s, many factories had closed their doors. But a lot of families stayed, and those families came from all over the world.
So it was very Italian-centric in the city, but there were also other ethnic groups. Bridgeport's always been kind of a melting pot for different cultures, immigration, and I think that's what made Bridgeport so special.
Ganim's family was part of the migration boom. His paternal grandparents moved to the U.S. from Lebanon, and his maternal grandparents moved here from Syria and Italy. When Ganim went off to college, he decided to become a lawyer. He comes from a family of them. Now, Ganim didn't tell us any of this himself. He didn't agree to sit down with us for an interview for this podcast. We learned this information from other places where he's talked about his life and from people who know him, like Caruso.
I went to school with Joe Ganim. I know him personally.
So you went to school with him. So when did you meet him?
Oh, in Notre Dame High School in Fairfield. Mid-70s, I'd say. Yeah, and then we graduated together and he went his way, I went mine.
Caruso is retired now, but he worked in city and state politics for years. After law school, Ganim worked in Bridgeport as a lawyer before deciding to give politics a try.
In 1989, I was his campaign manager in his very first run in 89, and he placed a very strong third, and that propelled him into 1991, when he was elected mayor.
When Ganim first came onto the political scene, he was young, in his late 20s. If you look at photos of him from back then, he wore round wireframe glasses, and he's typically wearing a shirt and tie. He looks eager and ready to work. He came into office when Bridgeport was in a state of crisis. One headline from the local paper at the time read, "Ghanem faces four crises in first month on job." One of the biggest, a budget shortfall of at least $20 million. The city was on the verge of bankruptcy. Ghanem's predecessor, Mary Moran, explains what happened. We talked with her outside a coffee shop.
Busey was my predecessor, and he had gone to the state to borrow money because we couldn't meet the payroll in Bridgeport. It was just a terrible time to be in any kind of politics.
The budget problems didn't start with Moran. They had been bubbling up for some time. Tom Busey, the mayor before Moran, says the city was navigating a lot.
At the same time when we're dealing with finances, the crack epidemic exploded out of nowhere. Nobody was prepared. Anybody says they were prepared for it, they're not being truthful. Police weren't prepared for it on the local level, on the state level, on the federal level.
In the late 80s and early 90s, Bridgeport had a huge crime problem. In 1990, the city had more homicides per capita than any other big city in the Northeast. That's according to FBI data.
Remember that those were tough times. They were times of the crack addiction, gangs, and Bridgeport was really desolate, really desolate. There were Jersey barriers in the middle of some of the streets to break up traffic patterns.
That's Mary Jane Foster. When Ghanem was first in office, she worked on development projects with him. She's now the CEO of a local nonprofit. It's safe to say Bridgeport was dealing with a lot when Ghanem took over. But within his first 2 years in office, some people felt like things were looking up. According to local news coverage at the time, Ghanem said he stabilized the city's finances, hired more police, and made other improvements. A lot of this was possible from state investments.
From a distance, it was, this is exciting. Someone young, fresh, smart, energetic has been elected. One of the things that Joe Ghanem did in his first administration is hire really smart people. And they really pulled together a plan, a cogent, coordinated plan for redevelopment of the city.
For some residents, one development in particular was a home run.
Hi, this is Mayor Ghanem. The city of Bridgeport invites you to Harbor Yard to watch a Bluefish game this summer. Come on and see everything that downtown has to offer.
In the late 90s, there was an opportunity to bring minor league baseball to Bridgeport. Foster was a part of its launch.
We pitched it to Mayor Ghanem, and he said yes. And 7 weeks later, we were in front of city council saying, if you give us $7 million, we'll get $7 million from the state. We'll put in $3 million and we'll build a ballpark. Nobody believed that it could happen. But 19 months later, the Bluefish opened and brought, I think, something like 3 million fans into Bridgeport over 20 years and about $40 million.
And so the Bridgeport Bluefish were born. This was a big deal for the city, and Ghanem received a lot of praise for it. But while he was enjoying political accomplishments, things would shortly take a turn. Lenny Grimaldi was born in Bridgeport and raised in nearby Monroe, Connecticut. Early on, he took an interest in Bridgeport politics. It started with an internship at the Bridgeport Post-Telegram, today known as the Connecticut Post.
I became fascinated working at the newspaper with the underbelly of the city, the guys and dolls, you know, who was running the city, the politicians.
Grimaldi loves talking about the city. Once you get him started, his eyes light up. Today, you'll find him writing blog posts on the happenings in Bridgeport on his website, Only in Bridgeport, or on his podcast, Chased, the story of Billy Chase.
It's Tuesday, listener, so get ready for some police corruption. First up is our documentary series from journalist Lenny Grimaldi.
But before all of this, Grimaldi once worked with Joe Ghanem, back in his first administration in the 90s.
No one wanted to be mayor then. The pay was $52,000 a year. Who wants to take over the city? So, you know, there weren't a lot of takers. So along comes young Joe Ghanem, who says, hey, I'll run.
Now, this wasn't Grimaldi's first time working in the mayor's office. He also worked with Tom Busey, mayor of Bridgeport, in the late 80s. Ghanem was a new face, and Grimaldi says he wanted to offer something new to Bridgeport. Ganim once said that he ran for mayor because he thought he could do better and that the city was lacking leadership.
We had, you know, developed a friendship, and he decided, like, you know, I'm in office now. Do you want to help me? I said, listen, I don't want to go back to government. I don't really like it, like getting you guys elected, but I don't really like it. He goes, well, listen, just come for 6 months or something. Help me set the office up, because I had experience in doing that with Busey. I knew where the files were, you know.
Grimaldi describes Ganim as charismatic, a quick learner, smart, and a good negotiator.
He looks you in the eye and makes you feel like you're important, and that's a gift. And he became very popular in the 1990s to the point where he was a rising star in state politics.
In the 90s, Ganim focused a lot on economic development. There were talks of a casino expansion in Connecticut. And at the time, developer Donald Trump had his eyes on Bridgeport. Grimaldi says Ganim introduced him to Trump, and Trump hired Grimaldi as a consultant, someone who could be his eyes and ears on the ground. And Grimaldi was paid a pretty penny for his work. The checks started rolling in, totaling more than $300,000 over the course of 4 years.
That was the start of my relationship with Trump, and, you know, things happened.
Now, we're not mentioning this Trump connection just because it's Trump, but because it's the moment when Grimaldi says he began feeling indebted to Ganim.
Both Joe and I made poor decisions as a result of that because, you know, he felt like, you know, I introduced you to Trump and you should be very grateful for it. So I was grateful in ways that I shouldn't have been. I'll put it that way.
Grimaldi says his gratitude eventually translated into a series of poor decisions that are now well documented. Some of them are spelled out in criminal charges brought against the Friends. They show how Grimaldi gave Ganim kickbacks in exchange for city contracts for Grimaldi's clients. Grimaldi was a consultant for companies that did business with the city. One of them was a wastewater treatment company. Ganim ordered Grimaldi to get his client to pay extra in kickbacks if they wanted a city contract. And they did.
In the 1990s, I did realize I was up to my neck in a lot of icky stuff. And I had to get out of it. You know, I didn't like it in the first place. I you know, internally, I was like, ugh, this is going to blow up. It's going to blow up.
The scheme wasn't just limited to that wastewater treatment company. Ganim also fraudulently concealed his purchase of a $1 million life insurance policy for himself using city money and conspired to have a developer pay an extra dollar for every square foot they built in the city. Ganim was even accused of taking kickbacks in connection with that Harbor Yard development where the Bluefish played baseball. But the jury didn't convict him of it.
It was summer 1999. I said, I'm not doing this anymore. I can't do it. I'm done. So, you know, I told some people, I'm not going to be part of this anymore. So I walked away from it. The government was on my phone at the time.
Hello. Hey, how you doing? Hey, Len, how you doing? All right. Listen, I don't want to fight with you, Len. We're too good of friends to fight. Yeah. I don't want to leave you like that. So let's get together this week and sit down.
Yeah, all right.
All right?
Okay.
All right, bye.
All right.
That audio you just heard is from an FBI wiretap back in the 90s.
So they heard. They knew there was a falling out, and I had walked away from it. Still, I mean, it still wasn't enough for me to completely save myself, you know, from being charged in incarceration.
Federal prosecutors found that extra money in kickbacks went to funding Ganim's lavish lifestyle. In the end, Ganim was convicted of soliciting and receiving more than $500,000 in benefits, including home improvements, fancy suits, and fine wines.
Welcome to Wine and Spirits. If you know your party's extension, please dial it now.
Good, who's this?
Joe Ganim, how you been?
Hey, Joe, how are you?
Good, where's the second store? Brantford?
Yeah, Brantford.
What exit?
Exit 54.
All right.
Where are you?
I just went by it. I'm at exit 71.
Oh, you're way by it.
Yeah, I know. Hey, listen.
Yes, sir.
About a case of 90 Lafitte and an 89 Pouliac?
Yes.
And anything else comparable?
Yeah, I got some 86 Latour.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, 100-point wine.
Well, can I come by and see you tomorrow?
The FBI overheard Ganim as he called a store to coordinate picking up his fine wines, which his associates paid for as part of the kickback scheme. What's interesting is that Grimaldi testified against Ghanem. Grimaldi turned his back on his colleague and friend. He was one of two critical witnesses to do so. This helped Grimaldi have his own sentence reduced. He ultimately served 10 months in prison.
I believe it was the judge in your case that said that they thought that you were the only person that had a soul, which I thought was an interesting comment.
Oh, Judge Arterton, yes. You know, that really meant something to me, you know. When Judge Arterton said that, I'm paraphrasing, you among the whole crew was the only one who didn't lose his soul. But then the next sentence was, but you must be punished. I laugh about it now, back then, but that was in the courtroom. Yeah, it was in the courtroom over 20 years ago.
When the news first broke about the FBI investigation, people took notice of Ghanem's reaction. He publicly and repeatedly denied any wrongdoing and carried on with business as usual. Eventually, Ghanem was indicted in 2001, but even during the trial, he denied his involvement. He maintained that he had nothing to do with the corruption and accused the witnesses of lying. Chris Caruso says Ghanem faced a lot of backlash for not stepping down, from himself included.
You know, we had heard rumors of things happening, and we had heard things that was going on. As an elected official, I was a state representative then, and I was the first one to call for him to resign.
He was at least one of the first, and Ghanem was eventually convicted on not one, not two, but 16 counts, including racketeering, bribery, extortion, and tax fraud. Even then, Ghanem didn't immediately resign from office. It took him a few more days to step down. Ghanem was ultimately sentenced to 9 years in prison, but he only served seven. Caruso says Ghanem's crimes have had long-lasting impacts on the city.
You know, what he had done to the city had hurt the city. It stymied the growth of the city. It continued that negativity from people outside of the city in the legislature, in the federal government, saying, you know, everything we do for Bridgeport is always wasted because of the corruption.
But did the corruption scheme have long-lasting impacts on Ghanem and Grimaldi's friendship? Grimaldi says since serving time in prison, he and Ghanem have turned over a new leaf.
And when I got out, you know, I started thinking about, what am I going to do? How am I going to reinvent myself? And I didn't want to go back to political consulting, although people did ask me. I just felt that, you know, I need to step away from that for a while, because I don't want people starting to say, oh, he's going right back into the hornet's nest, right? He didn't learn and blah, blah, blah. So let me give me some time. So I went back to my roots. I started doing a lot of writing. I went back, thankfully, the editor, Charlie Monahan at Connecticut Magazine, said, listen, you know, you want to write for me? You can write for me.
Despite everything that's happened, Grimaldi says today his relationship with Ghanem is solid.
It's a long time ago for me. I don't spend any time on it. And by the way, I laugh at it a lot. You know, we get together. We don't get into the weeds of what really happened. But every now and then we'll start laughing about something that took place, you know, back then, and now we can laugh about it.
Bridgeport politics had been in the spotlight long before Ghanem. John Mandonisi was elected mayor of Bridgeport in 1975. More than a dozen members of his administration were convicted on charges related to corruption. But Mandonisi himself was never charged. Bridgeport isn't the only city in Connecticut where public servants have been convicted of corruption. We've even seen it at the highest levels of state government. And I wanted to understand why. So one day last summer, senior producer Cassie Bassler and I left Connecticut and drove down to New Jersey.
Can we punch in the address? Do you know it?
Yes, the address.
We went to meet with former FBI agent Mike Clark.
3 hours, 22 minutes with tolls.
Head southwest toward I-95 south.
Hi.
We were greeted at the door by Clark and his dog Murph.
He'll come up and smell you, okay?
Who?
His name is Murph.
Ate Cassie's microphone.
Hi, Murph. Nice to meet you.
Say hello, okay? Oh, Murph.
When Clark first started working for the FBI, he worked in New York, and eventually he was transferred to Connecticut.
Our bosses, and you know, also in Washington D.C., determined that the FBI should be focused on big impact cases where you're going to make a difference, and the public trust is very important. So they peeled off some agents. We created a team.
We sat down at his kitchen table, and he started flipping through old newspaper articles.
The first real corruption case in Connecticut back in, I believe it was the early 90s, was the Sanpietro case. And that was in Waterbury. Joseph Sanpietro was the mayor, a very young mayor. And he and almost much of the town council was indicted, prosecuted, and convicted of corruption.
Similar to Ganim, Sanpietro was convicted of receiving kickbacks in exchange for city contracts. Not only that, but he also sought a return to public office after his time in prison. He was unsuccessful. There were also other corruption cases in Connecticut around that time. In the early 2000s, the FBI was investigating Waterbury Mayor Phil Giordano for corruption. They halted that investigation once they discovered he was sexually abusing young girls and prioritized the abuse case. On the state level, Connecticut Treasurer Paul Sylvester pleaded guilty to racketeering and conspiring to launder money in 1999. And former Connecticut Governor John Rowland was convicted of mail and tax fraud in 2004. He served 10 months in prison. Rowland later went to prison again in 2015 for campaign finance fraud.
All these great corruption cases are popping, you know, in our state. And, you know, we're getting great support from Mike Wolf, was our supervisor at the time, and he was just masterful at giving us the support that we needed.
Clark and his team had so much experience investigating corruption in Connecticut that they trained agents in other divisions on how to do the same in their area.
They say, okay, what are you doing? How are you doing this? And what's the secret sauce? What's your formula? And so they started to introduce us, and I think there might be an article here in the paper somewhere, I'll look for it, but I think the Hartford Courant coined the phrase corrupticate.
Did you catch that? There were so many politicians being convicted of corruption at the time that the state got a new nickname, corrupticate. Clark says wiretaps, like the ones from Ganim's case,
Joe Ganim, how you been? Hey, Joe, how are you?
Can be persuasive evidence in corruption cases.
The jury is sitting there and listens to Joe Ganim, to Joe Sanpietro, to Phil Giordano on tape. You know, they're wearing earphones, they're listening, and all of a sudden, as when you're an agent, you see them look up and look over at the defendant, and they have a whole different look on their face. All of a sudden, they're not, oh, that congenial mayor or that wonderful representative or that governor. All of a sudden, they're, you know, a bad guy doing bad things and with his own voice.
So what on earth was going on in Connecticut? Why was the state seeing so many of these types of crimes? Clark has a few thoughts on that.
Two common themes that through all these corruption cases, you know, that we could talk about. One is there's a sense of entitlement.
Politicians aren't necessarily more entitled in Connecticut than in other states. But Clark says there was a dream team of federal investigators dedicated to sniffing them out in the early 2000s.
In the second part, I found that many politicians, when they first go into office, they're dedicated to doing the right thing. And they're surrounded suddenly by people who are political. And some of their old friends fall by the wayside. And so the lens that they make decisions on are based on politics and not necessarily on what's good for the people.
What's different about Ganim's case is that unlike any of the other politicians we mentioned, Ganim won back his political office after everything. And he continues to get reelected, even when the odds are stacked against him. After his conviction in 2003, The New York Times wrote, it was a career-ending blow, and they couldn't have been more wrong. Ganim did not agree to speak to us about any of this, but he did talk about his life and his experience in prison on a podcast called White Collar Week with Jeff Grant back in 2020.
Hi, folks, and welcome to White Collar Week. It's the isolation that destroys us. The solution is in community.
Grant himself served time in prison for wire fraud and money laundering. He now runs a support group for other people convicted of white-collar crimes. Ganim reflected on why he's still in office with Grant.
People, by and large, felt that we had done a a good job, because I don't think they would have ever reelected me after getting indicted, tried, convicted, incarcerated, and then coming back out for in this case was quote unquote municipal corruption.
Yeah.
Unless people thought there was something more there than just another individual.
Grant asked Ganim about what his family thought when he told them he was running for mayor again, even after being released from prison.
There's going to be a group of people that say, oh, Jesus, Joe, you know, that's Joe Ganim, whatever, the mayor. He, you know, they're going to accuse me of everything from stealing a hot stove to anything that bad happened. But there are people that do recognize that, you know, I was a good mayor, did a lot of good, and most importantly, could make a positive contribution in the future, regardless of what had happened.
After Ganim was released in 2010, he wasn't done with Bridgeport politics. He came back for more.
An ex-convict could be elected mayor when voters in Bridgeport, Connecticut, head to the polls. The city's former mayor, Joe Ganim, spent 7 years in a federal prison for corruption. Now he's staging a dramatic comeback.
On the next episode of In Absentia, we'll look at Ganim's comeback and how the city of Bridgeport gave him a second chance. This episode was reported and produced by me, Bria Lloyd, and by Cassandra Bassler. Jim Huddadeen is our investigative editor. Meg Dalton and Cassandra Bassler are our editors. The investigative team also includes Kate Seltzer and Ashad Hajila. Fact-checking by Danya Suleiman. Sound design and mixing by Adrienne Lilly. Music in this episode from APM. Additional editing help from Lily Tyson, Erica McIntosh, Robin Doyon Aitken, Vanessa De La Torre, Lucy Napafanchel, Katie Talersky, and Eric Austin. Archival news reporting by WFSB and CNN. Legal review by Hinkley Allen. Vanessa De La Torre is our chief content officer. To learn more about the podcast, visit ctpublic.org/VPT. I'm Bria Lloyd. In Absentia is a production of Connecticut Public.
From Connecticut Public Radio, this is The Wheelhouse. I'm Frankie Graziano. That was the first episode of In Absentia. That's the new Connecticut Public podcast. Congratulations, guys, on the debut. Coming up after a break, we'll talk to one of the reporters you just heard from. Yeah, you just heard her voice. Bria Lloyd. You're listening to The Wheelhouse on Connecticut Public.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford Healthcare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford Healthcare. Loneliness can be a significant health risk to people of all ages. Dr. Laura Saunders, a psychologist from Hartford HealthCare's Institute of Living, talks about social isolation and why we need to connect in person.
Loneliness actually is a pretty significant health risk for people that struggle with social isolation. It affects their blood pressure, it affects their immune system, it affects your willingness to get up and get out, and can cause some not just emotional issues, but health problems as well.
You're not alone. Dr. Saunders explains how important it is for us to look to others and get out of our comfort zone.
I like to talk about social isolation as not just that individual's problem, but it's a community problem or it's a family problem. We need to connect with others. We can take space at times as well, but we need to step out of our comfort zone and do things to connect with other people. It's life-saving.
For more information, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
This is The Wheelhouse from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Frankie Graziano. Before the break, we heard the very first episode of In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public delving into the history of political dysfunction in Bridgeport. For the sort of behind-the-scenes look at that amazing podcast, we did talk to Bria Lloyd in there, and that was really cool. But now I want to talk to her, I guess, in person here. And Bria Lloyd is from the Accountability Project. Beginning to end here, how long did this investigation, this project, take you all to produce?
About a year. You know, we started doing this reporting last spring. And so now we're in April, and it's been about a whole year.
How did you go about the reporting? Like, was there somebody that you wanted to talk to right off the jump? Or were some of the places you went notable people you talked to?
Yeah, we talked to a lot of people. Initially, we made a list of a little over 100 people that we planned on talking to. We talked to journalists, historians, politicians, faith leaders across the city. We spent a lot of time going to a lot of different parts of the community, senior centers, churches, to really get to know Bridgeport and the area and the people who live there. And I think that was a really important part of our process, is just talking to as many people as possible. We also spent time in the East End, where people there, they recall Ganem and all of the hard work that he did there in his first time in office. And so that's why a lot of people there back him still today.
Anything that came out of the process that jumped at you, or maybe a development along the way that was most surprising?
I think the most surprising part was how many times we went to the polls, as you're aware.
The forever election here.
Yeah, yeah. As you're aware, we spent a lot of time at the polls. We didn't expect to
have...
Were
there four elections?
Yeah,
total?
There was two primaries and two generals, and we did not expect that to happen, you know, in our reporting process. So I think out of everything, that was the biggest shock to us, at least.
Does that kind of complicate things?
I think it just... You know, it changed a lot for our story. I think initially when we started doing this reporting, we wanted to just get a look at the dysfunction of politics in the city. And this whole, you know, saga of elections added a whole new layer to the story.
Why should folks listen to In Absentia?
I think it's important that people understand how important local elections are. A lot of these races are just decided by a few hundred votes. And so it's really interesting to kind of see, you know, why these are so important to people.
When's the next episode coming out?
Next week. So we'll be airing an episode every Tuesday for the next couple of weeks. So April 30th is the next day that our second episode comes out. And if you're curious and you want to listen to our podcast, In Absentia, you can find it on ctpublic.org/BPT or wherever you get your podcasts.
From Connecticut Public Radio, this is The Wheelhouse. I'm Frankie Graziano. Thank you so much to Bria Lloyd for giving us a window into the process of making In Absentia. Today, you heard just one episode of In Absentia. More is on the way, as we just talked about with Bria. New episodes drop Tuesday on all major podcast platforms and at ctpublic.org/BPT. And more is on the way with The Wheelhouse as we go from Bridgeport, Connecticut to Washington, D.C., listening to The Wheelhouse on Connecticut Public. This is The Wheelhouse from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Frankie Graziano. Political dysfunction is the theme of today's show. There's a lot of that going on right now in our nation's capital. There's the battle over federal funding and also over who should be in power. Here to walk us through the latest issues in national politics and how Connecticut's federal delegation is reacting to it, live from the Washington, D.C. area, Lisa Hagan, Connecticut Mirror and Connecticut Public's Shared Federal Policy Reporter. Thank you so much for joining me this morning. Good morning, Lisa.
Hey, Frankie, how you doing?
I'm so happy to talk to you.
Good to be with you.
Happy to have you on the show. And guess what? It sounds like, after talking about this with you for now 8 or 9 months, really since around the time there was the surprise attack on Israel, there's been this talk over federal funding, not just of Israel, though, but also Ukraine. And this has been something going on really since the federal fiscal year ended. So do we have a resolution, Lisa?
Yes, we have an answer. It is finally funded, the foreign aid bills that have been a big topic, a big ticket item in Congress. And they finally finished passing it last night. And so it went through the U.S. Senate, and I think President Biden said he will sign them all today. So it's this massive $95 billion foreign aid bill. So it'll go towards Ukraine, which has been a really big sticking point, Israel, humanitarian aid in Gaza, and then also the Indo-Pacific region. So that's been quite the topic of conversation, and it's been months in the making, and they finally passed it last night.
Taiwan included in that, too. I think that's where you say Indochina there. The just want to look at the big picture here with Israel and Ukraine. How did that end up shaking out in terms of the funding? I know you said $95 billion there, but was there any that was taken away there at the end, or was it more than politicians expected? How did that shake out?
I think it ended up being about the same as what they'd been planning for months. I mean, the biggest thing was getting it through the House. It was all packaged as one for a while, and the Senate was willing to take it up. And then when it got over to the House, whether it was, you know, some Republicans not wanting to support Ukraine aid anymore, whether it was some Democrats in the House being wary of funding more for Israel and wanting conditions on military aid, there were different sticking points. And so basically how they got it through the House, how Speaker Mike Johnson got it through, was basically in a procedural vote, he wrapped them all together. But when it came to taking votes on final passage, they passed each individually. And so when it came over to the Senate, they bundled it all back up again, basically. But that's how basically they need to govern now. I mean, there's just different factions in each party that are not thrilled with certain things that they're passing. And so that's kind of how it got through. But a lot of this aid is going to be going to Ukraine, which is still, you know, fighting a war against Russia.
I'm going to ask you more about Mike Johnson in a second, but we do have that resolution also on federal spending and avoiding a shutdown. That's happened since the last time that we talked. But it's sort of the continuing resolution flavor, and there is a fiscal year that'll end in 6 months. So, like, is it all solved?
Well, they're just in the beginning of stages of trying to figure out fiscal year 2025. And so it's just a revolving doors in Congress. They're always having to, it's all cyclical. We're back where we started. We're, you know, they're trying to, you know, fund the next fiscal year. And so, yeah, they have about 6 months. I don't know if they can figure out a long-term solution. Again, we might be in the same boat where we're seeing short-term funding bills passing, but very early stages of trying to figure that out. It'll be right before an election. I can't imagine they're going to want to get into a shutdown fight. But I think the big question again is whether they'll do it in piecemeal short-term bills or if they can fund it for a full year, which is typically how this is supposed to happen.
Again, the latest news is that the Senate passed the aid package there after the House did. So when the House did, you actually got this very strong response from Mike Johnson, the Speaker of the House, a Republican, that was really strongly coming out against Russia. And I think that surprised people. So it sounds like he's able to survive at least that vote. I want to get into Johnson's future, but I want to get into what Democrats think about it, mostly because Connecticut's delegation to Washington is all Democrats. So help us understand, if anything, that we might know about what Connecticut Democrats are saying about Mike Johnson.
Yeah, I mean, the Democratic Party is trying to keep things a little, they're keeping it close to the vest at this point because there is a motion to vacate that is not privileged at this point. So we don't know if it'll get taken up, when it'll get taken up to potentially oust Mike Johnson. And so Democrats are kind of keeping their strategy a bit private at the moment, but they've started to openly kind of consider what to do if Republicans decide to oust Johnson. And so Congressman Jim Himes of the 4th District, I mean, again, no one's exactly taken a position what to do if it comes to saving Mike Johnson, if it gets to that point, but he's at least entertained what Democrats might do. And so basically what Congressman Himes has said is he deferred to Hakeem Jeffries. He's the House Democratic leader. He has also said it isn't Democrats' job to always provide votes needed to, you know, either get bills passed or for Mike Johnson to keep his job, you know, especially because they're in the minority. But they've at least seemed open to considering it. And so I think what it would take would be deal making with Republicans to getting certain votes. I mean, they got Ukraine aid passed. That was a big one. And depending on what kind of, you know, governing body it'll look like, they keep talking about a coalition government. So what will that look like in the months ahead? Will Democrats and Republicans keep voting on bills together to get it through? I guess we'll see.
What about new legislation? Any bills members of our delegation are proposing?
Yeah, there's a lot, but there's a bit of a backlog now. I mean, again, the Ford Aid bill took up so much oxygen, same with trying to fund the government for months. So now that we're past that, you know, it's going to really depend on if the House wants to vote, you know, to oust Mike Johnson. That'll take up more bandwidth. But the bills that I've been following from the delegation have been the Kids Online Safety Act. That's been a big one for Senator Richard Blumenthal on implementing privacy protections for kids and how they navigate the internet. It's gotten some momentum, but has largely stalled. It hasn't gotten a vote on the Senate floor yet. So that's a big one that I've been tracking. Same with a tax bill that would give tax deductions for businesses related to research and development, and also bring back a little bit of a boost, not a full one, but a bit of a boost for the federal child tax credit. That got through the House and passed. It's also stalled in the Senate. And then the farm bill, that's really the big one for Connecticut and the rest of the country, that they basically extended it through September. And so that'll coincide with the government funding deadline. So a lot for Congress to do, and unclear if they'll take it up, especially if they're busy potentially.
So we're really unsure if anything could pass at this point.
It's really unclear. Okay. And this stuff always gets really tricky when we're headed into an election. They just don't want to really take up controversial legislation, and they're going to be out campaigning a lot. They're not going to be in session for much of the rest of the year because they'll be on the campaign trail.
Speaking of the campaign trail, you did a story recently updating our listeners and viewers on campaign finance in the race for 5th District. There, it sounds at least that we may have a rematch between Jahana Hayes and George Logan.
Yeah, that one is really starting to heat up pretty fast. It seems likely it'll be Jahana Hayes versus George Logan. The money battle is really starting to heat up. I mean, Republican George Logan has been increasing his fundraising. He had a fundraiser with Speaker Mike Johnson, speaking of, in Connecticut, in Hartford, not that long ago. He's also had other Republican leaders come to the district or to the state to help him fundraise. But, you know, Congresswoman Jahana Hayes, she's seeking a fourth term. She still has a lot of money in her bank account. She has about double the amount of money of George Logan. So in terms of money, she's still pretty well positioned in that way. But I'm expecting a lot of money coming into that district, and not just to the candidates, but that outside spending that we saw millions of dollars of in the 2022 election.
Any other candidates as we finish up here that have either declared or indicated interest in seats currently filled by our delegation? Murphy's seat's also coming up there too as Senator Chris Murphy.
Yeah, Senator Chris Murphy has three Republicans. I think there might be potentially more running against him, but he is pretty poised to win re-election again, just the nature of it. Republicans have been pretty open about the difficulty of trying to unseat him. He has $9 million in his bank account. So if he were to get quite a challenge, he would have the money there to spend it. There is a potential rematch in the second district, the eastern part of the state, against Congressman Joe Courtney. Republican Mike France is also running again. So we might see some rematches. But again, the big one is going to be the 5th district. And I'm sure even, you know, with the Senate race, Murphy will get some attention in that way too.
Lisa Hagan going to continue to follow the money and the candidates as the 2024 general election continues. Keep up with ctpublic.org and ctmirror.org for more of those stories. Take care, Lisa.
Thanks, Frankie.
Hey, a note before we end the show. You may have heard me Friday on the Colin McEnroe Show. If you didn't, check it out. ctpublic.org/Colin. We watched the new political thriller Civil War and shared our thoughts on it.
There's no actual information about what the context of the Civil War is. And so it's really a Rorschach test, right? Where everybody who goes into this film is sort of projecting their own fears or their own, dare I say, fantasies of what a Civil War might look like onto the movie.
That was one of the panelists on the episode, Zandra Ellen. She's a producer at Pineapple Street Studios. You'll remember we covered the intersection of Hollywood and today's politics back in March. You can listen to that in the Wheelhouse archives. Colin's show again is available at ctpublic.org/Colin. T Today's Wheelhouse was produced by Chloe Wynn, edited by Meg Dalton. Technical producer is Dylan Reyes. Our executive producer is my boss, Katie Talarski. Download the Wheelhouse anytime on your favorite podcast app. I'm Frankie Graziano. This is the Wheelhouse. Thank you for listening.